Hey, I want to say hi to everybody at all of our campuses, people joining us online all over the place. But especially I want to say hi to everybody in Sanctuary. Sanc, for those of you who don't know, is our ministry community of college, post-college, young adults. It's led by Abby McHugh. It's super cool, hip, and happening. I asked Abby if I should try to look cool and hip, and Abby said it ain't happening. And you all should know this, Abby got married exactly a week ago to Sam Odio. So congratulations to them. And Abby now has the most fun name of anybody on our staff, Abby Odio. Just saying it makes you happy, Abby Odio. So way to go, Abby and Sam. Now, some time ago, I went on a retreat, and one of the topics at this retreat was how everybody's created for mission. Every human being needs a sense of purpose and calling, and our life requires a mission larger than ourselves. God made us to be fired up, to be motivated by mission, to want to achieve mission, to want to celebrate having a purpose. But the speaker said something that stuck with me. He said, if we don't embrace our true mission, we all have what the speaker called a shadow mission. That is, we're all tempted to let our lives center around something unworthy or dark or selfish. And one of the guys at this event, it was kind of a non-faith-based event, one of the guys said his shadow mission is to watch TV and indulge himself sexually while the world goes to hell. Now, he put this in non-Presbyterian language, and all the guys around the circle laughed kind of nervously. And then he said, I want to say this again, but this time nobody laugh. My shadow mission is to watch TV and engage in this sexual habit while the world goes to hell. And the room got so quiet. And you could see every guy there thinking about how easily a life can deteriorate into the pursuit of such an unworthy purpose. That's a shadow mission. Now, the lure of the shadow mission is a danger for every human being who ever lived. But it's especially powerful right here in the Bay Area where we live. You're looking at the city right there. That's San Francisco, and it's a place where having a mission, one to change the world, or maybe one to make money, do all kinds of things, having dreams is so powerful, but it so easily turns into an ego-driven shadow mission. So we're starting a series this weekend to look at how to find and live out the mission that God has for you, and how to overcome your shadow mission. It's going to get us into real deep stuff. We're going to walk through one of the most amazing stories in the Bible over the next 3 weeks. It's the book of Esther. It's this story of characters given a choice between a mission and a shadow mission. People choose, destinies get formed, the world gets changed. We're going to get real deep into this amazing book, so I hope that you'll be reading this story, the book of Esther, in the Old Testament, over these next few weeks on your own. But we start the story now. The book of Esther is set in Susa, which is the capital of Persia. It concerns the people of Israel who are living in exile in Persia around the year 470 BC. Here's how it starts. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to the Nile. Now, the author wants us to understand this king, Xerxes, was a man of immense power. His kingdom extended across the known world. He's used to getting his way. He's preoccupied with showing off his greatness. But in fact, he has no inner strength of character at all. He constantly needs other people to make up his mind for him. His shadow mission was to look impressive and experience pleasure while following the path of least resistance. The first time we see Xerxes, he's throwing a banquet for his noblemen. There are three banquets in the first chapter of Esther alone. Literally, one of the ways to divide up the book is it's a series of parties, a series of banquets. We're told, for 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. 6 months, 180 days of serious partying. Are you kidding me? And then he throws another party, a second one, for the whole capital. This one's open for the common people so that all the hoi polloi will be overwhelmed by his greatness. Wine was served, we're told, this is from the text, wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink by the flagon, it literally says in the text. In other words, no restrictions, as much as you want. No restraint. Anybody ever see a movie called Animal House? That's what's going on in the first chapter. First chapter's all about serving Xerxes' pleasure and propping up his ego. Everybody said to him, Xerxes, you the man. And he didn't say, no, Haman, you the man. He said, that's right, I am the man. Now see, his true mission, everybody's got a mission, should have been to be a good king, to do justice, to serve the poor, to protect the vulnerable, to care for the orphan, to create a flourishing society. You think about what the Bay Area, what San Francisco would be like if everybody was living our God-given missions. The shadow mission is the difference between the king he should have been and the king he was. And it's not just Xerxes that has a shadow mission. There is a haunting poem written by T.S. Eliot. It was written at a time of great despair in his life, I think in 1925, with these words, "We are the hollow men in the twilight kingdom. This is the dead land. In between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. In between the essence and the descent falls the shadow. And this is just how things are. In between the man I could be and the man I am, in between the world as it ought to be and the world as it is, falls the shadow." At the end of that poem, or maybe the most famous words in poetry of the 20th century, this is how the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Hollow man. Back to Xerxes. He's got a shadow mission. Now, there's a third banquet in the first chapter. It's just for women, and it's thrown by the queen, Queen Vashti. There are no excesses, no juvenile behavior. The contrast between the king and the queen, her maturity, is very marked. Back to the text. On the seventh day, the king, when the king was merry with wine, it says, which he liked to be, he sent for the queen, Vashti. He had been showing off all his possessions to all the people. Now he wanted to show them his ultimate possession, his queen. What do you think he wanted to show them about the queen? Her brains? Think he wanted her to come and do math problems? Her personality to lead a lively discussion of the decline of the Babylonian Empire? No, not so much. He commanded his attendants to bring Queen Vashti in order to show the peoples and the officials her beauty, for she was fair to behold. Now you got to put yourself in this story. Imagine the humiliation involved for her. To this day, one of the ways the image of God in women is often devalued is by the message, who you are is how you look, which our world so often says, especially to women. So imagine being in her position. And then comes this extraordinary moment. This is so cool. Now, without this moment, the rest of the book, the heroism of Esther, never happens. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Somebody said no to the king, and it was a woman. Come parade myself before a crazened mob after 7 days of Miller time? I don't think so. Thanks for the invitation, King Honey, but I think I'll stay home and wash my hair. See, gang, it's amazing in a story when somebody, it's Vashti here in the first chapter, it could be you in your story, when somebody believes they have a choice to do the right thing if they just have enough courage, when the whole story's gone wrong. And I want to point out, it's very striking in the Bible that in this ancient book about a pagan system which insisted that male dominance must be enforced, the first hero in the story is a wife who refuses to submit to her husband. Now, how do you think this king, Xerxes, will respond? Think he'll say, oh, Vashti, you're right. That must have been so awkward for you. I'm sorry I mentioned it. My bad. Not so much. Then, when Vashti said no, the king became furious and burned with anger, falls the shadow. Vashti, she was making him look weak. She was threatening his shadow mission. Tons of irony in the story. Here's one piece of irony. So Vashti consulted the sages who knew the law. And the writer wants us to understand the irony in this. The most powerful guy in the world couldn't control his wife. So he turns to the Supreme Court. He makes it a matter of state. What am I going to do about my wife? Because, like, if the word gets out that I can't control my wife, all the wives of all the husbands in all of Persia will get out of hand. So the sages who knew the law, the Supreme Court, tell him to issue a royal order. Vashti is not to be allowed to come before the king anymore. Really? Those are the sages? That's her punishment? You don't want to come before the king? We'll show you. We'll forbid you to come before the king. And then they said that Xerxes ought to get a new queen. And then they added this. This is so rich. Again, this is in this ancient book. They said, you do this, king. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout the vast and magnificent realm, all the wives will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Yeah, that'll happen. I was thinking, reading through this part of Esther, every marriage has a shadow mission. And this is true for any relationship, for any significant friendship of yours. See, part of the God-given mission of a healthy relationship is that two people help each other become a better person. And marriage is a great crucible for spiritual formation, because that person that I'm married to, if I'm married, sees me and my flaws more clearly than anybody else in the world. So the God-given mission of a marriage will mean love and encouragement. It will also mean conflict and confrontation and truth-telling. But Xerxes didn't want that from his queen. He wanted a compliant, subservient, attractive junior assistant who would make him feel like he was a powerful man. Early in our marriage and our ministry life, Nancy and I were invited to speak one time to a group about marriage. And I thought, this would be great. We both like to speak. We're both married. And so we did it. And then right in the middle of the talk, Nancy started telling the truth. She started saying things that made it sound like our marriage wasn't perfect. And not just in an abstract, you know, way that's okay, we're not perfect. She gave details about, like, division of labor and emotional withdrawal and poorly handled conflict. She was honest in public about me. And I'm thinking, hey there, Queen Vashti, hang on. And it took me way too many years to realize my shadow mission in marriage was to project an impressive image of an enviable relationship. And Nancy would not collude in that. And I'm so glad now, I really am, honey. But I wasn't then. So you might think about your marriage or other key relationship in your life, key friendship or so, and ask, what's our shadow mission? Because all relationships have them. It might be conflict avoidance, or it's not my fault, or pseudo-intimacy, or propping up my fragile ego, or having kids that make us look good, or colluding in the pursuit of a materialistic lifestyle, or reinforcing smug satisfaction at our success, or enabling alcoholism or another addiction. It could be anger or physical abuse. It could just be co-rationalizing our refusal to be completely devoted to God. So I want to challenge you this week, part of this series, have a talk with your spouse or a real good friend. What's the shadow mission of our relationship? How do you see it? I really want to know. I really want you to be honest with me. You know, there's actually a whole stream of thought in some church circles that men, because of what it means to be a man, have this bottomless need for women to tell them how great they are and how much those women admire them. And that's a wife's job in a relationship, so that the husband can give her the affection that she, needy little creature, needs. Not the Bible's view of marriage. In a biblical marriage, there is mutual encouragement and mutual submission and mutual admiration and mutual challenge and mutual love. Thank God. Love to celebrate that. Those are the kind of marriages that we want to build around here. But Xerxes doesn't want that. He wants to get his ego stroked, and Vashti won't do it. But his advisors will, for sure they will. See, part of what's going on here is the writers are showing us what flatterers these advisors are. They talk about the edict being spread throughout the king's realm and how vast and magnificent that realm is. They all know his shadow mission is ego and appearance and pleasure. Make the kingdom all about me. They all know it. They all laugh at it behind his back, but they won't name it to him. The king has surrounded himself, and there's a real danger, with people who will reinforce his shadow mission. And by the way, in your work, in your volunteering, in your ministry, the higher up you go in an organization, the less truth you are likely to hear about the organization and about you. And I'll tell you, it goes on over in that little city all the time, just like it did in Susa. One of the signs that shadow mission is taken over is when people underneath the leader become more concerned about the leader's perception of reality than they are about reality itself. Because then the shadow mission of the community, the organization, or whatever, has become to placate the leader. And I will guarantee you, if you are leading something and you don't know what your shadow mission is, you are the only one in your circle that does not know. So I want to pause at this point in the story for a couple of real personal questions for all of us to wrestle with this week. What's your shadow mission? See, in the beginning of creation, God gave human beings a mission. So central to us. God created human beings. He made them God-like, reflecting God's nature. God blessed them, prosper, reproduce, fill earth, take charge, be responsible for every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. That's the first mission statement in history. It's part of why we love mission statements. On the same day God gave people life, God gave people mission. We were made to make a difference. That's why we love great causes. That's why we love to have a purpose. That's why we love to write such words. Our mission is to care for all that God has created and to cause it to flourish by working together with God under His authority. But then comes the shadow mission from the evil one. Disobey God, eat the forbidden fruit, he says to the woman, exalt your own ego, and this is a quote from the text, Genesis 3:5, you'll be just like God. So amazing. Our mission is to serve God. Our shadow mission is to replace God. And it's a funny thing. I've been through a lot of exercises in developing a personal mission statement, often wrestled with that, seen other people wrestle with that. We're going to talk about that more next week. How do you discern your mission with God for this season in your life? But I can tell you my shadow mission in four words, and I've known it since I was 12 years old. I had spoken someplace in my hometown, Rockford, Illinois, and the local newspaper did an article about it. I had four relatives that worked at the newspaper, so that's part of why. But the article was titled, Talkative Boy Wins Acclaim. And they didn't know it, but they were naming my shadow mission. And I know, apart from God's grace, it will make my life an exercise in self-idolatry and winning approval and emptiness, and I will be one of the hollow men, and I have felt that hollowness. And that's a battle I fight every day, and I will the rest of my life. So I'm asking you to have the courage to name your shadow mission. I'll name a few, just by way of example. See if one of those is yours or helps you to think about yours. There's a few shadow missions. I don't care who's in charge, as long as it's me. Or, show me the money. Or, busy, busy, busy. Or, I need to be needed. Will you need me? Or, perfect house, perfect marriage, perfect kids, perfect hair, perfect thighs, perfect dog. Or climbing ladders, taking hills, climbing over people. See, the Bible is full of characters who were tempted by a shadow mission. It's an interesting exercise to just name them. Solomon, it was pleasure. For Jonah, it was escape. For the Pharisees, for many of them, it was being holier than anybody else. And by the way, church, distorted spirituality, distorted religion is one of the most dangerous and damaging shadow missions in all of the world. Jesus talked about that so much. For Pilate, it was washing his hands and avoiding responsibility. For a character named Simon the Sorcerer, this is in Acts 8, his shadow mission was actually having a spectacular ministry. It looks so good. See, part of what makes a shadow mission so tempting is that it's usually closely related to our gifts and our passions and our callings. It's not 180 degrees opposite from the way that you're wired. It would be easy to say no to that. It will just take the desires and abilities and hurts and longings that you have and seek to twist them just 10 degrees off track. It's just, there's no Jesus in it. So, what's your shadow mission? Another question. What's the shadow mission of your family or your work or your department or your organization or ministry that you're involved with? Our church got started initially, 1873, just a couple miles away from Stanford, heart of the Bay Area, heart of Silicon Valley, a lot of people who have a lot of drive. And the staff at our church named its shadow mission years before I ever got to our church. They didn't use the phrase shadow mission, but that's what they were really describing. And I heard about it when I came to Menlo. Here it is. A successful church for successful people. Imagine that one on the sign out in front of our church. Imagine that statement on our stationery. A successful church for successful people. But without God's grace, we'll idolize that one. I was thinking, what if houses had signs in front of them? What if apartments had, you know, banners that had the shadow mission of the person or the family or people living inside? Successfully avoiding conflict for 22 years, passing judgment and feeling smug, pressuring overachieving little kids into early ulcers. I was thinking, this weekend is Father's Day. And I was at a memorial service a few weeks ago for a man from our church named Steve Miller. Some of you know him. And he led an amazing life. And I sat there in that room as all four of his now grown children stood together on the platform and they talked about their dad. And he lived an amazing life and he accomplished amazing things, but that's not mostly what they talked about. They talked about what kind of a dad he was, talked about how he'd encourage him. He had really high standards, but he'd cheer him on. His daughter went to the same college Steve did, and when she was struggling with her grades, he wrote to her, honey, I got a 4.0 at that school. 1.0 the first year, 1.0 the next year. Just like, I love you, it's okay. One of the most moving stories they told was when their dad was offered the ultimate job in his field, but it would have meant uprooting the family and disrupting their lives. And he said no to the highest rung on the ladder in order to say yes to his family. And I just want to say to dads, think about my own dad this weekend, for every dad who has sacrificed and prayed, who has devoted time and energy, who has sought to model and sought to teach, and sought to love, you are a hero. For every dad who has said no to whatever shadow mission might tempt you in order to say yes to God, you're a hero. For every dad or anybody else, anybody now, who feels like you have fallen short, you have given in to the shadow mission, you're wrestling with it right now. You don't know if you've got enough strength. You don't know if you believe God's got something better out there for you. There is good news. Jesus knows all about shadow missions. And I'll tell you what I think. I think Jesus faced a shadow mission. He was human like us, tempted like us. I think Jesus actually faced a shadow mission. And I think for Jesus, his shadow mission was to be the Messiah without suffering. There's a great New Testament scholar. His name was F.F. Bruce, and this is what he writes. Time and again, the temptation came to Jesus from many directions to choose some less costly way of fulfilling that calling than the way of suffering and death. But he resisted it to the end. He resisted the shadow mission. The very beginning of his ministry in the desert, Satan tempts Jesus to achieve his mission without hunger. Turn these stones into bread. It'll be spectacular. Or to achieve his mission without pain. Throw yourself down from the temple and the angels will bear you up and you won't have to hurt. Or to achieve his mission without opposition. You bow down before me and all the kingdoms of the earth I will give to you. Jesus says, no, no, no. Got to suffer. Later on, Jesus tells the disciples that he must suffer and die. And Peter tries to convince him that his suffering is unnecessary. This is exactly the same shadow mission. And this is why Jesus rebukes Peter so sharply, "Get behind me, Satan." I believe this shadow tempted Jesus all the way to the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is wrestling with this. And he says to his father, "Father, let this cup," now cup is an imagery of the wrath of God, suffering the anger in some way we don't fully understand of God over all of human sin, "let this cup pass from me." His shadow mission was, be the Messiah without the cross. But he said no to the shadow. He went to the cross. And on the cross he died for all the hollow men and all the hollowed women. When he was crucified, it's so interesting. It's like God is using the earth to paint the picture. We're told from noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over the whole land. In between the incarnation and the resurrection falls the shadow. In between the love of God and the sins of the whole world falls the shadow. In between me and you, sorry, sin-filled people, and our God, our Heavenly Father, falls the shadow. And on the cross, the shadow died so that we could be reborn, so that we could come to life. It's interesting, 2 years after T.S. Eliot wrote that poem, The Hollow Men, he experienced a remarkable conversion. He met Jesus. He became a follower of Jesus' way. And he was given a new purpose in his life. His poetry, which before then had been all about beauty and despair, thus ends the world, now points to beauty and hope. With his new faith, see, came a new mission, always. Here's the deal. You'll never be able to avoid your shadow mission by just trying to avoid your shadow mission. It's got to be replaced by something better, by a new, more noble, more compelling mission, the one that God created you for. So I want to say this. We're made to discover and devote ourselves to the mission that God has for us. How do we do that? All right, back to the story. After Xerxes cools off, he realizes he doesn't have a queen anymore. And so he gets advice on how do you find a new queen. You will not believe how this happens. His choice ends up being a young woman named Esther. She's beautiful, gracious, well-liked, and she's Jewish. It just happens. She's part of the people of God. Now, you remember, they're living in exile. They've lost their land. It looks to all of them like their mission to build a flourishing nation in their land, to be God's people for the sake of the world, looks to them like it's over. Well, Esther in exile gets to be queen. So her mission appears to be quite clear. It's to rule with Xerxes, to make him look great, to wear fabulous clothes and be famous and loved. So her story ends happily ever after, right? Not so much. Disaster's coming. Not just that. She's going to have to look at her shadow mission and her God-given mission, and she's going to have to choose. And if you want to know what happens next, if you want to know how do you discover your own mission for this place where God has you in your life right now, if you want to know what God is up to in giving you hard situations and why it is that you face difficult choices and tough obstacles and how do you identify what God has given you so you can achieve what God is calling you to do in the difficulties you're facing, come back next week. See you then.